I speak to you in the name of the living God, blessed Trinity, and lover of your souls. Amen. According to a 2019 Pew Research study of Christians, only 3% of American sermons talk about sin. I hate to burst your big purple Lenten balloon today, but this sermon is breaking the mold. In 2025, the Cultural Research Center at Arizona Christian University found that half of Gen X and millennial generations don't believe human beings sin. That percentage goes up about 10% for baby boomers and down about 10% by the time we get to Gen Z. 6 out of 10 of our youngest adults do not believe in sin, which tells me that sin is a concept our nation no longer understands. And as a Christian and a priest, this lack of understanding concerns me. The epistle of 1 John makes it clear that if we say we have no sin, we are fooling ourselves and might as well be calling God a liar. Martin Luther, that great church reformer, tells us that those who do not properly understand these evils, even though they lie right in the middle of them, cannot properly evaluate any of human nature because they do not know the source from which these calamities have come upon humankind. In other words, we need to understand about sin because without it, we will not be able to fully understand or describe the reality of the evils and sufferings we see around us. I wonder if our culture has stopped talking and learning about sin because it feels too much like a violation of our moral values. Sin encourages judgmentalism, right? Repression, not accepting people as they are, and creepy religious power dynamics. And it's kind of true. The church has done some creepy things with sin. From the 6th century to the Reformation, we priests used to keep lists of sins in our back pockets with corresponding lists of appropriate penance to give people. And sometimes forgiveness and absolution were withheld until those acts of penance were complete. This practice led many to think not just that forgiveness is earned, but that God is a transactional miser, meting out only enough forgiveness to keep us coming back for more. No wonder our culture doesn't want to talk about sin, even in church. But defining sin through the lens of specific acts of moral transgression is not how sin is best understood. According to a prominent Cambridge theology professor, specific acts of moral transgression are what we might call sins, but they are not sin itself. Sin is a condition under which human lives exist. Sin is a way of describing the fact that there is a fundamental flaw in the human system. It's an explanation for why that system keeps throwing up errors. The doctrine of sin is a way of saying that reality is like a lens with a subtle but pervasive flaw, such that everything that goes through it gets distorted. Plans go wrong, communications fail, good intentions decay and corrupt. There is a fundamental bias against flourishing, and it appears to be written on our hearts. So we have to think of sin as a condition. It's like gravity, only it causes enormous suffering. And we have forgotten how to name it. The word sin means the same thing in both the Old Testament Hebrew and New Testament Greek. It's an archery term, meaning you missed the mark. Sin is like Debbie Downer in the room, who can never name anything positive, only pointing out what's gone wrong. Sorry to all the women named Debbie. We love you. But we don't like talking about sin, because ironically, sin feels sinful to us. It's just always icky. Even in its earliest Jewish conceptions, sin was understood to be a kind of grimy residue that just built up within the community and needed an annual cleansing. But most Episcopalians seem okay with this idea of sin as the gross stuff that's stuck to everything. We can acknowledge sin out in the world in unjust uses of power, in the greed of the 1%, in legalized forms of racism, sexism, transphobia, covering our society. Like Ephesians says, our struggle is not against blood and flesh, but against the rulers, against the authorities, against the cosmic powers of this present darkness, against the spiritual forces of evil in the heavenly realms. When it's collective and abstract and systemic, we get sin. Like we get the concept of pollution. We know it's taken years for our world to get this bad. That all the wrong things have been building up in our society and politics for far too long. And we hope, with the best of intention, that if we can just tweak that system, we can start to clean things up again. But sin isn't something human beings can clean up on our own. It's a self-made condition that requires constant maintenance from the one who created us. Christian teaching tells us that the only thing that cleanses sin is God's grace. Grace comes from the Latin word gratia, meaning a gift, freely given. The Apostle Paul famously writes about grace as God's unmerited legal pardon for sin. But for those who think systemically about sin, legal pardon doesn't always feel like a proper cleansing has occurred. Sometimes it just feels like the elite are simply left off the hook while the rest of society suffers the consequences. Nearly half of American Christians say they get angry at God because God isn't doing enough about sin and suffering in the world. But Paul's legal way of understanding grace as God's pardon of sin isn't the only way that the Bible talks about these concepts. The biblical books attributed to John explain things differently. And we have learned, we have something to learn from the Eastern Church, which has shaped its theology of sin and grace on Johannine writings. One contemporary Orthodox priest defines grace this way. Grace is not a change in God's attitude toward a person. It's not a mere release from guilt. It is the very life-giving, transforming divine power and uncreated energies of God's very self. It's always received as a gift of God, never earned, by those who open their hearts and lives to receive it. And this grace saves us inasmuch as it brings us into one intimate union with the one who is salvation. See, John doesn't talk about grace as legal pardon for sin as much as he talks about grace as the energy that brings us into union with God. In Orthodox tradition, grace isn't experienced as an external gift handed to us by the divine who is out there somewhere. Grace is an interior gift of God's Spirit placed within our hearts. The question is whether we're willing to recognize that God's grace has been put there. And it's a hard question to consider, because to recognize that grace is in your heart requires first recognizing that sin is there. I wonder if this is why the prophet Joel tells us to rend our hearts so that we can get a real good look at what's inside. Opening our hearts is not easy. To rend something is to tear it open, and that sounds pretty terrifying. Especially if we fear something inside our heart might be wrong, that something in there might have missed the mark. The Orthodox tradition claims that this is why God has given us spiritual practice, known historically as asceticism. Our spiritual practices, like fasting, help us learn how to slowly and safely rend our hearts. Which brings me back to popping your big purple balloon. Now, I hope these 7 years I've been at Trinity help some of you trust that I would not pop your Lenten balloon unless I knew there was something really good inside of it. So, let's talk about what fasting in Lent is for. On Ash Wednesday, we learn about the practice of fasting from the biblical prophets. Today, Joel calls the people to a fast because there has been a national catastrophe, an unparalleled locust plague. The devastation of crops has led to the decimation of livestock. People can't eat. The devastation is interpreted as the day of the Lord, a day of ultimate judgment, many associated with the end of the world. But Joel realizes there's a good chance this plague isn't going to end the world. Some might actually survive the so-called apocalypse. And if that's the case, he knows God doesn't need the people of faith to duck and cover when things get really bad. God doesn't want the people to close their eyes and shut their ears to sin and suffering that's shaping the world around them. So Joel encourages them to face sin head on, to open their hearts to it, because wherever sin resides in our hearts, grace will be there too. Recognizing sin and grace is what we as people of faith are called to do. Because once all the unparalleled calamities and catastrophes and devastations end, and we, like Joel, realize it wasn't the end of the world after all, we too will be faced with a world torn apart by sin. And without rended hearts, there will be no eternal energies of God's uncreated grace loose in the world to heal it. Human beings can't heal the world on our own. Only God can do that. But God has chosen to bring healing to the world through our sinful, open, human hearts full of grace. Your heart is where God has seen fit for divine grace to live. So, I invite you to maybe re-examine your planned Lenten practice this year. If you unknowingly or unintentionally treated it kind of like a New Year's resolution, fasting isn't a way to test your willpower or become a healthier self. Fasting during Lent is our annual ask of God to wash the grime of sin from the walls of our world. By first beginning with all the grime built up in the walls of our hearts. So instead of fasting the usual suspects this Lent, like chocolate or beer or cursing, instead of taking on that new exercise trend, consider instead a fast from ignoring sin. Don't give up sin this Lent, take it on instead. Rend your hearts enough that you can see what's inside. Get up close and personal with your condition of sin, and I promise you, you will find the remedy of God's grace nearby. Do this not only for yourself, but for our world. Because someday soon, our society will be ready to talk about human sin. And when it is, we Christians can help it talk about God's grace, too.